Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Melanie Cantor. She was a celebrity agent and publicist for over 30 years. In 2004, she hosted a makeover show on Channel 4 called Making Space. And in 2017, having just turned 60, she was scouted on King's Cross Station, subsequently appearing as a real model in the recent Dove campaign. Her debut novel is called Life and Other Happy Endings. Back with us on the book show is Peter Stafford Bow. He has 25 years experience in the international wine trade and has worked for some of the world's largest supermarkets. His first novel, Corkscrew, became a bit of a cult classic in the wine world. His third book, featuring wine buyer Felix Hart, is out now. It's called Firing Blancs. We also have Molly Green, a seasoned author of fiction and non-fiction. Her latest novel, A Sister's Song, is set during World War II. It's a gripping tale of courage, love, loss, and camaraderie, showing how music has the power to shine a light in even the darkest of days. And finally, on tonight's book show is Gillian Harvey. She's a former teacher who began her freelance writing career when she moved to France in 2012. Her latest book, Everything is Fine, is about Jessica Bradley's search for happiness. Her thousands of social media followers think that she has it all, but what she portrays online isn't really a true reflection of her life. That's on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Drench yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Melanie Cantor, who was a celebrity agent and publicist for over 30 years. Her clients included Ulrika Johnson, Melinda Messenger, and Melanie Sykes. In 2004, she hosted a makeover show on Channel 4 called Making Space. And in 2017, having just turned 60, she was scouted on King's Cross Station, subsequently appearing as a real model in the most recent Dove campaign. She's with us on the book show to talk about her first published novel. It's called Life and Other Happy Endings. Welcome to the book show, Melanie.
Well, thank you. Lovely to be here.
Oh, it's lovely to have you with us. There's so much I want to talk to you about.
I hear my life played back to me like that, it's like, wow, that's pretty extraordinary. It's like, really? That happened to me?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. So before we talk about the book, want to ask you a bit about your time working as a celebrity publicist. You met and worked with some very interesting people.
I did, yes. Ask away.
Well, Adam Ant, good story about him.
It's so funny because of all the people that I've looked after, Adam Ant seems to resonate with people. And it's really interesting, isn't it, the names that kind of catch. But obviously the story about Adam is that I looked after him for his comeback. I wasn't there in his heyday, as it were, but I looked after him for his comeback, which was kind of 84, 85, and it was the release of the single Apollo 9. And anyway, at the end of that year, so he did Live Aid that year, but I couldn't go because I was pregnant. And at the end of that year, December, I had Alexander, my first son, by emergency caesarean in the Royal Free Hospital. And that's a national health hospital. But anyway, because of the caesarean, I suppose, I don't know, but anyway, I had these massive ankles. They were deeply unattractive. Oh. So when I knew visitors were coming in visiting hours, I tucked them away. You know, no one wanted to see them. But obviously, Adam slipped through the net because he was adamant. I suppose he charmed his way through. And I wasn't expecting any visitors. And I was sitting with my legs dangling over the side of my bed. And he came round and was standing there with this cuddly toy for Alexander. And he looked at me and his eyes traveled down. And he went, "Melanie, what has happened to your ankles?" And it was like mortifying. Oh, my God. And I've never forgotten that moment.
Oh, bless you. Oh, dear. There was also a fun moment with Carolina Hearn at an award ceremony.
Yes, well, I didn't know Caroline, but I just happened to be standing next to her at this particular kind of party. And obviously we now know all the problems that she had, but she was quite drunk, and for whatever reason she decided to use me to prop her up, and I'm not that big. So she put her full weight on my shoulder, and I literally took a tumble and she tumbled with me.
Oh, no.
So that was my connection to Carolina Hearn, and she was quickly taken out of the room by her people. Poor girl. Anyway, now we know.
Yes. And you also worked with Paula Yates, another troubled soul.
Yeah, Paula was wonderful. I mean, I worked with Paula. I was kind of, you know, well, we were all sort of young then, but Paula, I was working for a theatre publicist at the time, and Paula was really making waves with that shock of platinum hair and one thing and another, and Peter Thompson, who I represent, who I work with, looked after her, and she would come and sit in my room and wait to see him, and we'd just chat away, and she was absolutely a lovely, lovely woman. Such an incredible, I mean, she had such an incredible aura about her. It made me, I had long lost touch with her when, after she, you know, before she died, but it was so, made that story so sad because she had so much to give and so much promise. It really is sad when that happens to fabulous people.
Yeah, definitely. And also Rupert Everett, huge fan of him.
Yeah, well, that's the same kind of thing. I mean, he won't even remember my name now, but he would come into Peter's office and sit and chat away. We did the publicity for Another Country, which was the show that effectively launched his career. And he was so outstanding and very, very striking. And again, a very lovely man, very easy to chat to. And I absolutely loved him. And subsequently, I've read both his autobiographies. And he's just hilarious. I think he's such a great writer and such a character.
Yes.
I adore him.
Definitely. I've read his books as well. I think he's brilliant.
Brilliant,
yes,
aren't they?
Absolutely. So
yeah.
Tell us about the makeover show that you did, Making Space.
Well, so Making Space, I mean, that came about, I had no intention of ever being a TV presenter, but I had a friend, Jill, who, you know, I obviously knew TV executives, but I'd actually met her when she was working in radio, and Peter Thompson is so significant because that's where I kind of would work with her, selling in some of our people that were in shows to go on to her program, which was on Capital. Got to know her and got to know her as a friend. So she came to see all the houses because I'm a house obsessive. I move every couple of years. And she got to see all the houses that I made over. And back in, I don't know, 2002, 2003, she said, "I want you to be my new talent. I want you to come in and do this show. And you're going to tidy up people's houses because you have an ability to see a space and know how to use it properly." And it's funny when people see things that you don't even know about yourself, but that was what she spotted. And I have to say I was kind of resistant for a while, and but then I gave in. And I got the gig, so 25 shows on Making Space, and there were a lot of bin liners and a lot of skips and a lot of shelves, but a lot of happy people, so that was good.
Oh, yes. It can be difficult, can't it, for people to let go of things when they're used to keeping hold of things.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually, and seeing that in people where sometimes, you know, you become so overwhelmed by stuff that there's just no beginning to getting rid of it. You need somebody to come in and just get the process started. I think that's the thing. If somebody can help kickstart you and show you the way, then you can do it, but you just have to keep to it. That's the thing, is stick with it. So much nicer to be living without chaos around you. So I hope we solved a lot of people's lives,
yes,
in that small way, you know.
Definitely. And I'm sure it inspired others, you know, even watching a show like that. Hopefully other people at home will think, oh yeah, go on, all right, I'll give it a go, one room at a time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was the intention, so hopefully it did get picked up like that. I mean, in a way it was a precursor to Marie Kondo, and I don't think I was quite as, you know, decisive, and well, I was pretty decisive, but you know, not as what can we say, strict as her, but it was interesting because I think it was ahead of its time. Not that I would want to be Marie Kondo, I can assure you, but it was a show that really was kind of, yeah, I think it would work better now, although if you look at it now, because you can on All Four, it's so dated. My look is so dated, it's fabulous. It's kind of early millennium stuff.
Brilliant. And talking of your look, being involved in the Dove campaign, the Real
Dove
Women
campaign.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that kind of was blindsided me as well. I mean, how wonderful to turn 60 and to be told, you know, we want you for a kind of a campaign. One was, I was involved in two Dove campaigns. One was posters, which was never over here. It was global. They only discovered that I was on the Stockholm Red Line, big poster of me, my face looking over the platform, and because somebody was there and they took a photo of it, so I don't know where else it appeared, but it was quite extraordinary. And then I was in a TV campaign last year, which was fun. I mean, blink and you'll miss me, but I was there.
Wonderful. So how did you get around to writing? What inspired that side of things?
I'd always wanted to write. I'd always been writing from, you know, my early 20s, but never thinking this was something I could do. As a lot of people, I kind of feel it's like, you know, you don't feel you're entitled to be a novelist or whatever. Stuck with me, and I was so determined to not, you know, to not end my life with anything kind of left wanting, you know, that I didn't do. And so I thought, well, I will now give up being a TV presenter's agent and publicist, and I will write. And it was certainly no easy ride, but it took me 10 years to eventually write the book that appealed to the agent and then to the publishers and is now Life and Other Happy Endings. So it did have, I have my own happy ending.
Yes. And interesting that you talked about regrets then, because that's one of the themes of the book, isn't it? A lady who has regrets.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, the essence of the book, I mean, the starting point is this 43-year-old woman is given 3 months to live. And instead of taking the trip of a lifetime, she decides she wants to write to the three people in her life who kind of upset her, let her down, and finally tell them what she truly felt so that she wasn't left with regret. And so she puts her truths out there, and then 3 months later she discovers she's still out there. And so it's dealing with the kind of unraveling of all that. And it's really finding you know, the kind of, to really finding your true self and having courage and knowing the purpose of courage and grabbing life with both hands. So it's about not, you know, it's about seizing the moment. And we're kind of all facing that now ourselves anyway, aren't we?
Yes. Yes, it's an interesting idea that I think a lot of people would have thought about, the idea of really telling the truth and telling people what you really think or what you really know, and whether that would actually be a good thing or not.
Yeah, and that's the point, isn't it? Because when you think you've got 3 months to live, you think, well, I'm going to do it. I mean, I would never do it otherwise, but I'm going to do it. And the whole book kind of revolves around the fact that she does things that are under normal, well, go against character, which she wouldn't normally do. And then it's what the repercussions of all that is. And, of course, happy endings. But there's a long journey that she goes on in order to get there. But it is... You know, it's sort of, it is, even though it's about confronting death, it is definitely an uplifting book, because I think, you know, people, when I've read the reviews, it's like, my goodness, I thought this was going to be a really sad book, but it's so funny. And I think the point for me was, I like to be witty in my writing, but also, don't you think that when we're confronted by death or difficult moments, we use humour to get ourselves through it? So that's really what my character Jennifer does.
Yes, very important. So what can you tell us about Jennifer as a person?
Jennifer is one of those people who's incredibly honourable. She's the younger sister. There's Isabel, who was the pretty one, and Jennifer, who was the clever one, or at least that was how it was drummed into them. But obviously we learn about their real personalities, not just what they thought they were. But anyway, so she was the good sister. She was always the one that did the right thing. She always held her countenance and kind of, you know, she didn't like confrontation. And she was in HR, she was human resources. And suddenly she realizes that this is it. This is the end of the road. And I think her real authentic self starts to come through. The person that she always should have been starts to come through. I think that's a really fascinating subject to deal with. Who are we? You know, we accept the perceptions of other people to tell us kind of who we are and how we feel about ourselves. And we're so affected by other people's opinions. Sometimes we lose ourselves, and it's an interesting thing, because sometimes other people's opinions are helpful and sometimes they're not. And it's, where do we find who we really are without relying on other people? Who are we in our authentic lives?
It sounds like it was a really enjoyable book to write.
It was. It was fascinating. You know, I just getting under the skin of these characters, all of them, the men, sort of weak men, unreliable men. It was a very cathartic thing to write about.
Yes, I bet. And has it made you want to write more? Is this the first of many, do you think?
Oh, I do hope so. I had a 2-book deal, thank you very much. And so I'm really trying to write. In a pandemic, in lockdown, it's been very, very difficult, but I'm persevering. And I am so enjoying getting to know these new characters and going on their journey with them, which is a very, very different journey from Life and Other Happy Endings and Jennifer's journey. But it's still very much about character, understanding us, how we work, what makes us do the good things and the bad things, you know, our frailties and our strengths. I find people really fascinating, so
yes,
that's what I love writing most.
Well, we look forward to the next one, but for the time being, listeners can get a copy of Life and Other Happy Endings. It's available to buy on our website, tre.radio. It's by Melanie Cantor, who we've been chatting to. Melanie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Peter Stafford Bowe, who has 25 years' experience in the international wine trade and has worked from some of the world's largest supermarkets in the UK and abroad. Firing Blancs is Peter's third novel and the latest instalment in the popular Felix Hart series. We chatted to Peter when he brought out his first book, Corkscrew, which became a cult classic in the wine world. Welcome back to the Book Show, Peter.
Thank you very much, Hannah. It's a pleasure to be back.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you with us. And I love the title of your latest book. If I pronounced it Firing Blanks, which is what I initially thought could possibly be the way people would think it was a book about infertility or something, but that's not the case.
Firing Blanks, definitely. Hopefully, yes, people get the pun then.
Yes, very clever. So for people who haven't read your last two books, just tell us a little bit about Felix Hart, can you?
Yes, well, Felix Hart is a cheerfully amoral, rather badly behaved supermarket wine buyer. They say write what you know, and I worked for very large supermarkets for several years. So I'm not saying it's an autobiographical set of books at all, because I'd be in prison or dead, I think, if it were. But yes, Felix Hart is this cheerfully amoral character who gets himself mixed up in all sorts of shenanigans with the law, you know, with the mafia, with all sorts of other authority figures, and generally comes out smelling of roses. Now, no spoilers for the third in the series, Firing Blanks, of course, but he's obviously still alive because it's the third book of three so far. But yes, the novels are set in the world of wine and big business, specifically big supermarket chains, some multinational supermarket chains, and really they're satires that explore, you know, the interaction of the employees and the suppliers with these big corporate businesses, and there are lots of fun sort of in-jokes for people who are into the world of wine as well, but you certainly don't have to be a wino to enjoy them.
Mm. So how did you get into that industry yourself?
Oh, well, I was a university dropout, actually, back in the days when you could just about get away with doing that in the sort of early 1990s. And I was working out what it was I was going to do. You know, was I going to, you know, retrain as something else? And in order to earn some money, I got a job in the local off license, a chain called Victoria Wine, which are long gone now.
Yes.
Not my fault, but yes, they were a power in the land at the time. And I got a job with them as a shelf stacker, and discovered, and I didn't know much about wine at all, but I discovered I enjoyed it. And they were quite good in those days, companies like that. They did train you on wine knowledge. So, you know, they gave you all these cassette tapes, and I would listen to them on my Walkman in the shop in quiet hours and fill in my workbook. And I thought, this is fascinating, you know, the vineyards of Europe and the New World. And I was reasonably good at selling as well. So I won a couple of sales incentives, which sent me off to Australia and New Zealand for a couple of weeks. And I thought, you know, forget university, I'm going to carry on doing this. So essentially that was the start of it. I became a manager of off licenses and then larger and larger stores, and ultimately became a wine buyer at a big supermarket chains.
And when did you become passionate about wine? I mean, there's a difference between knowing a lot about something and being good at your job to actually being passionate about it.
Yes, well, I'd, you know, drunk wine from the age of, well, whenever you're allowed to drink wine, or maybe slightly prior to that. But it was the point at which I started to become educated, you know, thanks to my employer, and realizing that you could buy two bottles of wine and open them, and they were from different regions, or they were made from different grape varieties. You know, take a Fitou from the south of France and compare it to a Pinot Noir or something, and you realize that they actually tasted different, and the reasons why they tasted different. So really, that was the point at which I thought, this is really quite interesting. And I wasn't earning much money, so I was still living at home, much to my parents' chagrin. But my mother quite liked wine, so, you know, I'd sort of do my homework with her, you know, in the evening, and say, look, I've brought home some more bottles, now let's taste this. And I was making little tasting notes, and she found it quite interesting as well. So in the end, they were reconciled to me being a dropout, because actually it led in a rather different direction.
Yes. So does it frustrate you when you come across people who don't know anything about wine, to the point where they might say things like, I don't like red wine, or I don't like Chardonnay, or whatever, just kind of blanket statements that, you know, if you sort of educated them a little bit, could easily change their mind?
Well, I try not to be frustrated, because it can be very complicated, can wine. I mean, you can spend a lifetime studying just one particular district of one region on wine, so there's no reason why anyone should feel they have to be an expert. But yes, I think there are a few kind of very vague myths floating around, like, you know, red wine gives me headaches and things like that, which people just sort of start to believe. And then, Yeah, and it's a shame that they're depriving themselves of such a wonderful experience because of these myths. But no, there's no reason why anyone should have to know about wine. But once you've got a tiny bit of knowledge, actually, it really sort of liberates you, and somewhat lifts the kind of fog of confusion over what all these different names and things are. So it's always worth learning a little bit about wine, which I try to do. And then when people's eyes glaze over, I stop talking.
I'm fascinated by price as well. In Spain, oh, yes, particularly, where I live, yes, the wine can be incredibly cheap in supermarkets. I mean, yes, unbelievably so. And you can, different people, depending on how much money they have to spend, how much they really enjoy their wine or whatever, you know, people can go to the supermarket and think, wow, it's an amazing bottle of wine for just €7. And then others can quite happily spend €2 on a bottle of wine and really, really enjoy it. Do you think there's a lot of kind of correlation between price and a good bottle of wine?
Well, there is, yes. The thing is, you're very lucky in Spain because there's no excise duty on wine at all. In fact, in most European countries, there isn't. I mean, in France, it's a couple of pennies. But unfortunately, in the UK and in the Republic of Ireland, it's more like £3 per bottle. So actually, in Spain, if you spend €2 on a bottle of wine, you've got to spend about £6 or £7 to get the equivalent quality in the UK. So in Britain, we're rather, most people who buy wine in supermarkets, the amount of money they're actually spending on the liquid itself is often only about 20 or 30 pence, if they're buying a £4 or £5 bottle of wine, because the rest is tax. So in Spain, you get much better value anyway. But really, no, ultimately, you do get what you pay for. And I think even though not everyone can afford to spend £5 to £10 or euros on a bottle of wine, it's worth every so often just splashing out a bit and spending something nearer to 10 than to 5 or less if you're in Britain, and realizing that you really get so much more for your money, because the amount that you're getting, the amount of your money that's going on the liquid in the bottle itself, that can be 30 or 40 times as much money, when you've taken all the tax away. So, for spending twice as much, you get a wine that could be 30 or 40 times better.
Yes.
And I'll explain the economics around that as well. But yeah, it's a very dark art is wine pricing.
And I always wonder realistically how many people would really notice the difference on a blind tasting. There's been lots of cheaper wines that have won awards from some of the cheaper supermarkets and sparkling wines as well that have won some awards that are much, much cheaper. And I wonder if there was, lots of wine experts from around the world doing blind tastings, which I know does happen, how many people would straight away be able to identify the more expensive and supposedly better quality wines over the cheaper ones?
Yes, I think if you had two bottles of wine in front of you and one of them, in a Spanish context, if it's €1 or €2 and the other one's €10, I think everybody would be able to say, oh, wow, yeah, I get why that's the €10 one. It'll taste thicker and juicier and, and might be more mellow. There might be some oak and so on. Whereas the cheaper one will probably just be a kind of nice, fruity little number. Now, so I think people can tell that. Whether they actually prefer one to the other is a different thing, and wine's very subjective. So, if you really find you don't like wines that are more concentrated and have more structure, then you definitely shouldn't buy them. But I think it's also worth saying, once you get to kind of €30 or so, once you're spending more than that on a bottle of wine, you're not really getting fundamentally a better quality of wine. You're just paying for more profit margin for someone, because you're paying essentially for scarcity or fashionability of the wine. I mean, it's pretty difficult to make a wine in such an expensive way that it ends up costing more than €30 or £30 for that matter, unless you've gold-plated your combine harvester or something like that. it's just impossible to physically add that much value to the cost price of production.
Yes.
So that, I'd say the ceiling is there. So, people are spending hundreds of pounds on a bottle of wine, they are giving their money to somebody else's bottom line. They're not fundamentally getting a better quality of wine. But I think, €2 versus €10, certainly you should be able to tell the difference.
Yeah, interesting. So looking at the new book then, Firing Blancs,
yes,
a lot of it is set in South Africa.
Yes, it is. I mean, I lived in South Africa for a couple of years, and you know, it's an absolutely fascinating country. You know, beautiful country geographically, and you know, I think it's actually the history and future of mankind in microcosm, which sounds very grand and highfalutin. But you know, when we look at what's going on in the modern world, and you know, modern identity politics, and we look at the civil rights struggles and the demonstrations and even the riots that are taking place right now in various countries in the world, you look at South Africa, and actually you see that painted absolutely in primary colours. So I think it's a fascinating place to base any novel which is about identity politics and its kind of slightly cynical reflection of corporate woke washing, which is something that really interests me, the fact that big corporations try to make out that they have the same values as customers or consumers when they don't at all. It's the bottom line they're interested in. So it was just brilliant to be able to set a novel there, and particularly in the Western Cape, where you have the beautiful winelands and all these historical wine estates, which are staggering in their beauty. I mean, I think the Western Cape is probably the most beautiful wine-producing area in the world. I mean, I've been to nearly all of them. I mean, most wine is produced in rather nice nice surroundings and, you know, nice continental climates, etc. But the Western Cape is beautiful. But then absolutely cheek by jowl, you have the townships where, you know, millions of people live in very substandard housing, often just tin shacks, you know, and these line the motorway as you drive from Cape Town to the winelands. And I think that juxtaposition is really interesting as well, that those two worlds can live so close to each other, and is ripe for storytelling and satire, for that matter.
Mm. And where does South African wine kind of sit in relation to wine from around the world?
Oh, well, I'd say it's an absolute bargain. I mean, South Africa produces superb wine. They make very nice, accessible, cheap wine. It's a little bit harder to get hold of it in certain European wine-producing countries, because people just tend to drink the produce of their own country, of course. So you won't find much in Spain, I don't think, certainly not outside the more fashionable bars in Madrid or Barcelona. The wine is superb, and not only do they make good value wine, they make some very, very good premium wine that is very little known, actually. It's only in small parts of probably the British and maybe German and Dutch kind of wine trade that you see wines like that. But the South Africans are making superb wines now. They've sent their young winemakers all around the world since the opening up of that country a good kind of 20, 30 years ago. And, you know, so all their young winemakers have studied in France and Australia and the Napa Valley, and have come back and are making fabulous wine. So because it's not that well known in terms of most export markets, you can often get quite a bargain. So I think you get great bang for your buck drinking South African wine if you can get hold of it.
Yes, yes, I know what you mean. It is difficult to get hold of wine,
yeah,
not just from South Africa, but as you say, from any other country other than the country that you're in. I lived in Spain for 17 years now, and I don't think hardly ever do I drink wine from another country.
Yeah.
There's an Italian restaurant near us which actually does specialise in Italian wine, which is nice. But on the same token, going to Italy on holiday, you can't get anything other than Italian wine. So
no,
it's,
indeed. Yeah. And often, I mean, you can't even get wine from outside the very region that you're in. So if you're in, if you're in Rome, you know, it's all Lazio. You know, if you're in Tuscany, you know, it's all Chianti, etc. And the same in France. So yeah, you have to be in the big cities really, where you might have slightly more metropolitan, slightly more cosmopolitan outlook. But you know, it's no great problem just to have to drink Spanish wine, because there's just a fabulous variety of wines in Spain. It's just getting better and better as Spanish wine. I had a beautiful bottle last night from the Penedès, which was not knocked my socks off, a beautiful white wine. So, yes, it's not the worst place in the world to enjoy wine, is it?
I'm not complaining at all. Well, it's lovely to chat with you, as always, Peter Stafford-Bow. Thank you very much for joining us. And
my
listeners
pleasure.
Can get a copy of your latest book. It's called Firing Blancs, and it's available on our website, tre.radio. Peter, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. All the best, and enjoy your next tipple.
The Book Programme. presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Molly Green, who's a seasoned author of fiction and non-fiction. She's had various interesting and very different jobs. She's modelled in Atlanta, she's assisted the UN narcotics director in Geneva, and has assisted a famous film producer in the UK. She's with us, back with us in fact, on the Book Show to talk about her latest novel, A Sister's Song. Welcome to the Book Show, Molly.
Oh, hello. Thank you very much for having me. I'm really pleased to have a chat with you again.
Oh, no problem. It's lovely to have you back. So how have you been these last couple of years?
Yes, very busy writing. I think since we last spoke, I've had at least two more books out, with A Sister's Song coming out at on the 25th of this month. So Avon worked me very hard, but I'm enjoying it.
Yes, and you've been writing full time for a while now.
Oh yes, I have. Yes, about 6 years, I should think.
Yes, and do you miss all of your interesting jobs that you've had in the past, or have you found your calling now?
No, none of them. I mean, it's really strange when you're a writer. It's very strange how you can drag up something from your experiences. And you think, oh, how did I react to that? And then that takes you back into how you were, and you think, oh, yeah, I enjoyed myself then. Oh, that was pretty awful. But apart from that, and I don't miss it, because I know I've done it, and I'm the age I am, and I'm thoroughly, thoroughly enjoying being a writer. That's just a dream come true for me.
Yes, lovely. So are you able to look back on some of the careers and things that you've done in the past and use any material for your book?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is what I really do frequently, and I think, I can't believe that I'm using this. And the more that you think about the past, the more detail comes up. And, it's good and bad, as our lives are. But, yeah, I'm using stuff, very often, but also supplemented heavily by loads and loads of research, because I'm writing for Avon HarperCollins. They have me in the Second World War slot, which I really love. I'm very comfortable there. I mean, I was born a bit later than the end of the war. However, I know of stories that my mother particularly used to tell me. My father, not so much. I think the men were, clammed up a bit more. But my mother has told me quite a bit, and I can use, proper detail that she's told me, knowing that it's true. It comes from a person rather than just reading it in books, so that's all good stuff.
Yes, brilliant. So looking at the latest book then, it is set in and around World War II as well. Yes. Tell us a bit about the setting, can you?
Well, the setting is a little bit different this time, because the other books, I've really kept them more on sort of home front. The heroines haven't really ventured out. But A Sister's Song, it's about Suzanne, who is the second sister. So the first one came out, A Sister's Courage, and she was a ferry pilot in the ATA. And so the second middle sister, Suzanne, is a different girl altogether. She's very musically talented. She's classically training on her violin and piano. But she wants to do her bit as soon as the war starts, and as soon as she's old enough. She's only 18 actually when she starts on her journey, and she decides, against the wishes of her fairly dominating mother, French mother, that she's going to join ENSA, which is the Entertainment's National Audio Services Association. I always stumble over that one, because I always want to think that I want to use their euphemistic name, which is Every Night Something Awful. But anyway, they entertain the troops, and and big names were, big swing bands and big comedians, a lot of famous people did join ENSA and travel all over the world. So she joins ENSA, and she's sent to Malta. And it's only a few months after the siege of Malta, so Malta is in a shocking state. And there she goes, and she's been very sheltered in her life, so this is a huge awakening for her.
And wonderful to be able to entertain people with music and bring a little kind of hope and joy to their lives.
Well, it is. She hoped she was going to be a violinist, because they did have some, you know, classical concerts, but they didn't need a violinist. And so she thought, well, she could, you know, they said to her, can you sing? And she said, well, I've had no training or anything, but I enjoy singing around the house. So she sort of stunned them that she actually has got a lovely voice, and her heroine has always rather been Vera Lynn, you know, sort of going in the world and singing to the troops. So they say, right, you know, you're going to be a singer. Well, of course, she's quaking terribly. She's shockingly nervous, because she's all very well singing around the house and somebody telling you you've got a nice voice, but singing to hundreds or sometimes thousands of troops was a very different thing. So I've had her going through terrible nerves, and but she comes through, of course, and the chaps absolutely adore her.
Oh, lovely.
And then there's some romance along the way. She's already got her heart with a naval officer, and she just wonders if they will ever meet again, which is, you know, a little bit of an echo of the Vera Lynn.
Yes, very clever. So do you have to do, I mean, you mentioned research earlier, you obviously know this period of history very well, the Second World War now. Are you still constantly kind of reading and finding out more about it?
Yes, because even though I knew that, I only knew the basic thing about, I've been to Malta for one day years and years ago, so I only knew that Malta was the worst hit of anywhere, including London in the Blitz. They had the worst bombing of anywhere in Europe. So I thought that would be really interesting to read about. Well, I've got a stack. If you could see my stack, I've got about 10 or 11 books about it, and some memoirs, some pilots who flew in the siege of Malta, because I wanted to get the background of how it, you know, how it did become so badly torn up. Some research on ENSA, you know, singing to the troops and how that worked. And I get lost in research. I start reading a book and I think, I'm just going to pick out some salient points. I'm going to skim this, but the book is almost always so fascinating, I have to go from cover to cover.
Wow,
so
fantastic.
It takes a lot to get me where I need to be. And I'm only using fractions, you know, tiny little bits, but hopefully they are details that will bring my book alive and bring the story alive.
Yes. Yes, it must be difficult to kind of not put too much in. You don't want it ending up being a sort of factual account of what happened, do you?
Yeah, we call that in the trade an info dump.
Yes.
And readers don't really like it. You have to sort of weave it in, but you need to weave it in. If you're writing historical, I think you need to be grounded in what's going on. And I'm always accurate. Well, I'm as accurate as I very possibly have checked that I can be, because it's not right. I have read novels, historical novels, where the author is said, oh, well, I had to twist a few things, take a bit of, you know, artistic license. Well, I don't agree with that. To make the story work for me, I think that's really wrong. I've got the history is there, what happened, and then my story has to, you know, go weave in and out of the happenings at that time.
Yes, yes, so I think that's better.
You have to be accurate. But I've been very lucky that I have got good contacts, probably a lot of them made in my life of perhaps the state agency more than anything, that I can always call on somebody to help me or give me a bit of advice or send me a bit of, you know, research knowledge that they know that I wouldn't. And so I do rely heavily on a little group of people around me for each book I'm writing.
Yes, that's brilliant. Great stuff. I love the expression info dump. I'm going to use that.
It's
thank you.
Isn't it?
It's fabulous.
And the readers even know it now, I think.
Yes, great. Well, if people want to get a copy of the latest book, it's called A Sister's Song, and it's on our website, tre.radio. It's by Molly Green, who we've been chatting to. Molly, thank you for joining us again.
Hannah, thank you very much indeed for inviting me, and I hope to talk to you again about the next one that comes up.
Lovely.
The Third Sister.
Great,
so
great.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks, Molly.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Gillian Harvey. She's a former head of department and English teacher who began her freelance writing career in 2012 after a move to France. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her latest novel, Everything Is Fine, and it's all about Jessica Bradley's search for happiness. Welcome to the Book Show, Gillian.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So tell me about your move to France, first of all. You started writing more when you moved there.
That's right. I mean, I'd always written in my spare time, but obviously when we first moved to France, I had a lot more of that. We were both teachers in the UK, my husband and I, and it was just really a spontaneous move. We wanted to do something together. We felt we were being too stretched, and we just suddenly thought, let's just give it a go. So we really moved over without a lot of preparation, but it's worked out.
Oh, good. And you're happy there?
Yeah, we've had our ups and downs here. We've when we first got here, we moved to quite a remote village, and it was great for a year or so. And then after that, you start thinking, where are all the humans? And so we moved to a little town now, and it's better. So we're very happy, yeah.
Oh, great. And whereabouts in France are you?
We're in the Limousin, which is sort of two-thirds of the way down in the middle. There's lots of lakes and things around here, so it's quite rural.
Fabulous. So looking at your book then, Everything Is Fine, it's called, and the main character is Jessica. Tell us about her.
Well, Jessica came from my idea that we're all faking it a little bit online. We don't post the kind of outtake photos with her eyes closed and things like that. We try and make the best of ourselves. And she's someone who's taken it to the extreme, and things have taken over. So she's a blogger, and she runs a fitness blog, which she didn't really do for anyone but herself, a more kind of organic blog to keep herself motivated. But somehow she's gathered this massive following of people who are now expecting her to tweet wonderful pictures of her fit body and great tips. And the problem is, like a lot of us, after a couple of months on the fitness journey, she started to slip. But she loves being followed, and it's helping her PR business. So she's trying to keep up appearances. And that includes trying to fake it in real life sometimes as well. And the comedy, I guess, in the novel comes between that disconnect between what's happening online and what she's really going through in real life.
I bet a lot of women can relate to that. I suppose it's difficult to, you can scroll through social media and see people's pictures and think, gosh, that everybody else seems to have it all sorted.
That's right. That's the thing. And I sometimes wonder. I mean, I'm on social media, so I'm just as culpable as everyone else. But I sometimes wonder what it's all for, in that a fake version of me meets a fake version of you, and we become friends. But is that actually real? And that's kind of what the book looks at.
Yes, interesting. And has your opinion on social media and what you see online and even what you post online changed throughout the writing of this book?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite ironic because obviously the lockdown happened when my book was released. So it's been social media I've relied on to promote it and get it out to readers a bit. So I've seen both sides of social media. And I mean, I love Twitter, and I love kind of connecting with people. I'm not very good at Instagram because I can't take a selfie to save my life. But I think trying to be authentic in what you're putting out and realistic is what I aim for, and sort of stays within the sort of real boundaries of my life, rather than trying to promote anything that's not real, I suppose. But I do get the same. We all know, I think, when we look at Instagram, that these photos are staged and that people are showing what they love, and it can be very inspiring. But we also know that obviously it can also make people feel quite bad about themselves. And I suppose that's the bit I don't like, that sort of feeling of always competing all the time, no matter what you're doing, and never quite measuring up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And do you think that readers will like Jessica? Are they sort of on her side?
I hope so. They're certainly meant to be. I think because she's within herself, she's just trying so hard. She's never wanted to be fake, but she's trapped by all the things we get trapped by, this popularity, and also that her sudden popularity on Twitter and Instagram has meant that her little business has taken off and she's employing people, and it's all based on this social media image she's created. So although it's a little bit self-serving, I suppose, she's also trying to keep the rest of her life together, and it all seems to be pinned to this perfect person she's pretended to be.
And how are her friends with her?
I think her best friend, Bea, is the main friend that you see in the novel, and she's really down to earth and sees through all of it and teases Jessica about it a lot and doesn't really get it. And it's her that really helps Jessica to see that she doesn't have to be anyone else online. She can just be herself, or at least try to explore that idea a little bit more. So her friend's not taking any rubbish from her, really. She's not buying into that image, and that's because obviously their friendship sort of predates all of this that's happened to Jessica as well.
Yeah, I think people like to see the other side of people's lives, don't they? People like to see that things don't always go right. There are great examples of that on online. Instagram versus reality and things like that is a fun one. And there's that Celeste Barber, who does the videos and things, copying models, doing weird and wonderful. She's hilarious, isn't she?
She's brilliant. Yeah. And I think that's it. It's just knowing that it is great to be inspired. And there's lots of accounts I follow that I think, yeah, I wish I could be more like that person, or I really admire what they're doing and I want to know more about them. And it's nice also to see that there is a kind of middle ground, isn't there, between that and what everyday people are getting up to.
Absolutely. Well, if people want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called Everything Is Fine, and it's by Gillian Harvey, who we've been chatting to. It's available on our website, tre.radio. And have you already started the next book?
I have. In fact, I finished it because it's been quite a long lead up to this one. So I was able to get scribbling in between. So quite excited about the next one as well.
Oh, great stuff. Well, good luck with that as well. Gillian, thanks ever so much for joining us.
That's brilliant. Thanks for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.